Yeah, so first I'd like to say thank you very much for inviting me to give a talk, and also thanks for the introduction. So I will be talking about conformal embedding of random planar maps, which is based on a joint work with Shinson. So we start by recalling that the norm in a variable is a random variable which is appearing in a huge number of settings. So approximate normal random variables appear for example, in experiments with coin tosses. And it also appears to describe the distribution of heights in a group of people. So one reason, so we say that the normal random variable is universal because it appears in so many settings and describes the asymptotic behavior of so many discrete models, typically such that the limiting behavior of the model is independent of any noise and is independent of the precise details of the model. So a normal random variable is a universal random variable. We also sometimes say that it is a canonical example of a random variable. So we say this because it has a number of properties and symmetries which are seen as natural. So for example, if we consider the standard normal random variable, we add n independent copies of this, and then we renormalize the sum of these random variables so that the variance is one and the expectation is zero, then the random variable we get is again a standard normal random variable. So this is one property which is uniquely characterizing the standard normal random variable, in the sense that if you look at the blue text on the slide and you replace it with something else, then the statement is no longer true. So the normal variable is an example of a random object which takes values in R. It's also possible to consider universal and canonical random objects which take their values in other spaces. For example, one can consider random functions defined on R+. One can consider random curves in a plane. One can consider random functions defined on R2, and one can also consider random surfaces. So one can argue that that the five objects which are shown on the slide, they are not natural examples of random variables in each of these five classes of objects. So after the normal random variable, the second simplest example is probably that of the Brownian motion. We will start by looking at that model converging to the Brownian motion. So here we have a simple random walk. So it is a walk which is going either up by one or down by one at each integer time. And it is defined such that the different steps are independent of the other, and they are uniformly distributed on plus minus one. It is a classical result that if we rescale space by n, and we rescale space by root n, and we send n to infinity, then this simple random walk is converging in a scaling limit to this Brownian motion. So just like the normal random variable, the Brownian motion is also a random object which is arising in a huge number of settings, and it's used to model everything from financial markets to a number of physical phenomena. For example, if you look at the random movement of pollen grains in water, then this movement can, so each coordinate of the pollen grains is approximately given by an independent Brownian motion. So just like the normal random variable, the Brownian motion also has a number of natural properties. For example, it is the unique random function, which is equal to zero at time zero, which has expectation zero at any point in time, and which has increments which are independent and identically distributed. So that was a very brief introduction to the Brownian motion. So next, I want to look at a discrete model which is converging to this random fractal curve, which is known as the Sturm-Löwen revolution. So here we can see a percolation on the triangular lattice. So this means that each site of the triangular lattice has been colored independently at random in blue or yellow. So percolation, it was first introduced as a simplified mathematical model to study how fluids move in porous material, for example, a porous stone. So here we can assume that the blue sites, they represent holes, while the yellow sites represent solid material. So here you can see a blue cluster. So it is a connected component consisting of only blue sites. And when so I said that that the different vertices are color independent at random, and if we let blue and yellow be equally likely, then the model is at its critical point. So this means that if the probability of blue is slightly larger than a half, then with probability one, there will be an infinite blue cluster somewhere. Conversely, if the probability of blue is slightly smaller than a half, then it holds with probability one that there will be no infinite cluster. So these clusters are interesting because it explains how fluids can move in our porous material. So for example, if we have an infinite blue cluster, then in principle, a fluid could move all the way, could flow all the way to infinity. While this is not the case if all the clusters have a finite size. So here I have considered the triangular lattice restricted to some rectangular box, and I have marked two points, A and B, at the boundary of the box. One boundary arc of the box is colored in blue, so the vertices are colored in blue, and the vertices on the other arc are colored in yellow. So in this setting, there is one can prove that there is a unique interface between blue and yellow, which is connecting these two marked points. If you follow this interface from A to B, then it holds that every time the path is entering into a triangle, then it turns right if there is a blue vertex out of it, and it turns left otherwise. So if we compare this rectangular box with a porous stone, as we could be viewed as a porous stone, then this percolation interface, it is representing the interface between the parts of the stone which may get wet if we dip it in water, and those which have to stay dry. So if we keep the size and shape of this rectangular box fixed and we make the lattice finer and finer, then this percolation interface is converging to this random fractal curve, which is known as a Schramm-Löhn revolution. So this follows by combining works of Smirnov and of Kamiya and Newman. So in the proof, which shows that this percolation interface is converging to the Schramm-Löhn revolution, the hardest step is to show conformal invariance of percolation. And this was proved by Smirnov. So to explain what he proved, then we consider some arbitrary simply connected domain D, and we consider four points, A, B, C, and Z, such that A, B, and C are on the boundary, and Z has some arbitrary location. So in this setting, one can consider the event that there is a blue path which is connecting two boundary points and which is separating the points B and C from the points A and Z. So Smirnov proved that if the size and shape of the D is fixed and we make the lattice finer and finer, then the probability of having such a crossing is converging to a constant. And he also proved that this constant is conformally invariant. So what this means is illustrated in the lower part of the figure. So in the lower part of the figure, then there is a conformal map, psi, which sends the domain D to the standard equilateral triangle, such that the points little a, little b, and little c are mapped to the three vertices of the equilateral triangle. So in the setting, we can look at the image psi of Z under this conformal map, and Smirnov proved that the limiting probability of having a crossing, it only depends on this point psi of Z. So in other words, the limiting crossing probability can be written as P sub A of psi of Z, where P sub A is some function. Smirnov also proved that the function P sub A is linear, such that it's equal to 1 at the vertex A and it's equal to 0 at the points B and C. So that was a quick background on SLE and percolation, which will be relevant to later in the talk. So what we will be doing next is to look at the main topic of the talk, which is random surfaces. So in the rest of the talk, we will be looking at two models for random surfaces. We will be looking at random planar maps and Liouville quantum gravity. So as we will see, a random planar map is a natural model for a discrete random surface, while the Ewald quantum gravity is a natural model for a continuum random surface. And the main result I want to present, it is a result which is saying that this random planar map, it is converging in some sense to Ewald quantum gravity when the size of the planar map is going to infinity. So a planar map, it is a graph drawn on the sphere and which is viewed modulo continuous deformations. For example, the left and the middle planar maps in the figure, they are considered to be the same since we can get from one map to the other by doing continuous deformations, deformation, namely we can deform this edge which is colored in blue. On the other hand, the middle and the right planar maps, they are not considered to be the same. So again, we can get from one map to the other by moving this edge, which is marked in red, but this deformation is not considered to be continuous. So a planar map where all faces have exactly three edges is known as a triangulation. For example, the planar map shown in the middle and left parts of the figure, that's an example of a triangulation. So remember that the planar map has been drawn on the sphere, which means that the complement of the graph is also a face. And you can see that this face also has exactly three edges. So if we have some natural number n, then there are finitely many maps which have exactly n vertices. There are finitely many triangulations which have exactly n vertices. And when we work with random planar maps, then we assume that our planar map has been chosen uniformly at random from such a finite collection of planar maps. So before I continue, I want to show you a simulation of a large random planar map. Can you see it here? Yeah, I think you can. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So in this figure, you can see a triangulation. So it is a triangulation which has 20,000 faces, and it has been chosen uniformly at random from the collection of triangulations with so many faces. As I mentioned, a planar map, it is only defined modulo continuous deformations. So therefore, if you have a triangulation, there is not a unique way to draw it. But when making this drawing, one has attempted to draw the planar map so that all the edges have approximately the same length. So it's not possible to draw the triangulation such that all the edges have exactly the same length, but one has drawn it by applying an optimization procedure where one has attempted that all the edges have approximately length equal to one. So this is made, the simulation is made by Nicola Kurian. Then I can continue. So planar maps, they are objects that arise in a huge number of settings, in many different branches of both math and physics. The study of planar maps in the math literature, it goes at least back to the combinatorics literature in the 60s, when Tuttmullen and others were proving enumeration or counting formulas for planar maps. Later, they have been studied in, for example, geometry and in random matrix theory. So they are relevant for random matrix theory because it turns out that certain matrix integrals can be expressed in terms of sums over planar maps. One application which is relevant for this talk is in random geometry. So here, probabilists are interested in understanding the geometry of large random planar maps. Another relevant application for us is in conformal field theory and string theory, where planar maps are used as models for random surfaces. So next I want to introduce what we call a Ewald quantum gravity surface. And in order to do that, I first need to introduce the Gaussian free field. And we start by considering the discrete Gaussian free field. In the left part of the figure, we consider a rescaled version of Z2 restricted to the unit square. So if we have a function defined on the vertices of that graph, then we can define its Hamiltonian by considering the sum of the square differences between adjacent function values. It's possible to show that if one fixes the boundary data of a function, then the Hamiltonian is minimized if the function is a discrete harmonic. So the discrete Gaussian free field, it is a function which is defined at random, such that the probability density relative to the product of Lebesgue measure on the vertices is proportional to e to the power minus this Hamiltonian. So in other words, the discrete Gaussian free field, it is a function sampled at random where we favor functions such that the Hamiltonian is small. So in particular, we favor functions where adjacent function values are not too different. In order for this to make sense as a probability measure, we also need to introduce some additional constraints. For example, we can say that the boundary data are equal to zero, which gives us the zero boundary Gaussian free field. From this definition of the Gaussian free field, it's possible to argue that if we consider some fixed point z and we consider the value of the function at that point, then that will be a normal random variable, and it will be a normal random variable which has mean zero and which has a variance of order log n. One can also argue that there is a covariance between the values at different points, such that the covariance is of order the logarithm of the inverse distance between the relevant points. So on the previous slide, I defined the discrete Gaussian free field. So one way to define the continuum Gaussian free field is to say that it is the limit of the discrete Gaussian free field when n, which is the inverse lattice size, is sent to infinity. So if we go back to the previous slide, we see that the Gaussian free field at any fixed point, it's actually diverging when n is going to infinity, because it is a normal random variable which is diverging logarithmically. So therefore, it's not obvious how to make sense of this limiting object. And in particular, this Gaussian free field, it is too rough and irregular to be well defined as a function. But it's possible to show that this Gaussian free field, it is well defined as what we call a generalized function or a distribution. So this means in particular that if we consider some fixed point z, then h of z is not well defined. But it's possible to, for example, take the average of the Gaussian free field over some open set, integrate it against some smooth function, and so on. So for example, if we have some point z and we have considered the ball of radius epsilon centered at this point z, then the average of the Gaussian free field on the boundary of this ball is well defined. Yeah, I can also mention that this average, it will be a normal random variable. And it will have expectation zero and values of order the logarithm of the inverse of epsilon. So one small remark is that one reason the Gaussian free field is natural is because it can be viewed as an analog of random motion in the case when time is higher dimensional. So if we go back to the previous slide, and then we carry out the exact construction described, except that instead of considering z2, we're considering just the integers z. We replace z2 by z here. So the function we get then is going to be a Brownian motion instead of a Gaussian free field. Another remark is that it's also possible to give a formal or heuristic definition of the Gaussian free field directly in the continuum via path integrals. So the idea here is that we consider a Lebesgue measure on the space of functions, and then we reweight this by e to the power the action, where the action is obtained by integrating the gradient squared of some function over our domain. So this definition of the Gaussian free field doesn't make rigorous sense, for example, because Lebesgue measure on the space of functions is not well defined. But it is possible to, but it, but it, but we can see in particular that that this for a formal path integral definition, it is a natural continuum analog of the discrete definition, which was given on the previous slide. For example, because this action is a natural continuum analog of the Hamiltonian considered before. Okay, so that was some background on the Gaussian free field. So next, I want to explain what we mean by a level quantum gravity surface. So to explain this, we first assume that h is some smooth function defined on the unit square, and that gamma is some parameter between 0 and 2. So then it's possible to define, using h and gamma, it's possible to define some area measure mu, and also a distance function or metric d in this unit square. So we get an area measure by rewriting a Lebesgue measure by e to the power gamma h. So in other words, we consider a measure, the measure mu is a measure such that the density of the measure relative to the Lebesgue measure is given by e to the power gamma h. So since we are in the plane, then if areas or volumes are rescaled by e to the power gamma h, then it's natural to let distances be rescaled by the square root of this. So therefore, the natural metric or distance function associated with this measure can be obtained by the second formula, which is shown in the indented equation. So here we say that if p is the path, then we say that the length of this path is obtained by integrating e to the power gamma times h divided by 2 along this path. And then to get the distance between these two points, then we take the infimum over all paths connecting the two points. So what I defined in the first bullet point works in the case when h is a smooth function. So gamma level quantum gravity surface, it is the surface we get if we let h be the Gaussian free field. So as I mentioned on the previous slide, the Gaussian free field is not a smooth function. It is instead a generalized function or a distribution. So therefore, it's not obvious. How to make sense of this surface, because since h is not defined pointwise, it's not obvious what e to the power gamma h means. But it is possible to argue that the measure and the distance function can also be defined in the case when h is the Gaussian free field. So the idea here is that instead of using h to define a measure and a metric, we use some regularized version h sub epsilon of h. So we let h sub epsilon be some smooth function, which is an approximation to h. Then we use h sub epsilon to define an area measure and a metric. And then it's possible to show that this measure and metric converge when this regularization parameter epsilon is sent to zero. So the construction of measures of this type is classical, and it goes back to the 70s and 80s. The construction of a distance function or metric is much harder, and the construction of this was only completed in 2019. So this construction of a measure and a metric, it works for all gamma between 0 and 2. But the special case when gamma is equal to the square root of 8/3 is playing a special role. And the reason is that this variant of Liouville quantum gravity is the variant of LQG, which is related to uniformly sampled planar maps. And LQG for gamma is equal to the square root of 8/3 is often called pure Liouville quantum gravity. On this slide, you can see an illustration of the Liouville quantum gravity area measure for three different values of gamma. So heuristically speaking, you can think of the different colors as showing the density of the Liouville measure relative to Lebesgue area measure. So in the regions where the Gaussian free field is particularly small, meaning that the density of the measure is very low, then these regions are shown in gray. On the other hand, the regions where the Gaussian free field is very large, meaning that the measure has a very high density, they are shown in turquoise or green. One thing one can notice is that when gamma is large, then there will be certain regions with very high density and certain regions with very low density. So this happens because when gamma is large, then the Gaussian free field gives a bigger distortion of a Lebesgue measure. On the other hand, when gamma is smaller, as for example in this left figure, then one can see that that the measure is more uniformly distributed. Okay, so here you on this slide you can see an illustration of the Liebel quantum gravity metric. So what we are looking at is a metric ball for three different values of gamma. So the color of a point in the figure that's indicating the distance of the point to the center of the square, while the black points is the set of points which have distance more than one to the center of the square. So again, you can see that when gamma is small, then the geometry of the surface is closer to the standard Euclidean geometry, because you can see that that this symmetric ball looks much more regular in the case when gamma is small. Well, when gamma is larger, we get a much bigger distortion of the Euclidean geometry. So far in the talk, we have been looking at these two models for random surfaces, random planar maps and Liebel quantum gravity. So both of these two models for surfaces were studied in the physics literature in the 80s. And in this literature, random planar maps were viewed as discrete versions of Liebel quantum gravity. So it was assumed that the random planar maps are converging in some sense to Liebel quantum gravity surfaces when their size is going to infinity. So this relationships between planar maps and LQG, it was used for several purposes. For example, it was used to predict or calculate the dimension of random fractals and exponents for statistical physics models. So these calculations were not fully rigorous, but they have been confirmed rigorously by mathematicians by using completely different methods. So it was somehow understood that random planar maps, they are discrete versions of LQG. But understanding and making sense of these ideas has been a mystery to mathematicians for at least 10 years. So the first question that a mathematician would typically ask is what does it even mean for a planar map to converge to LQG when the size is going to infinity? And there are several different ways in which one can define convergence of a planar map when the size goes to infinity. So the slide is listing three different ways that one can attempt to prove convergence. One can attempt to prove that the metric structure of the planar map is converging. One can attempt to prove that properties of the planar map when decorating it by some statistical physics model is converging. And one can also attempt to prove that the conformal structure of the planar map is converging. So the first two notions of convergence stated on the slide, they will not be too important for the purposes of this talk. So I will not be giving any precise definitions. I will just remark that that convergence of planar maps in these senses has been established. So instead, I want to focus on this notion of convergence in the third bullet point, which is convergence of this conformal structure. And what I want to do next is to define precisely what I mean when I say that the conformal structure or the conformal properties of the planar map is converging. So when we say that the conformal structure of the planar map is converging, what we mean is that the planar map is converging under a conformal embedding. So this is illustrated in this slide. So in this slide you can see one planar map which has been drawn in two different ways. So in the left figure, it has been drawn in a similar way as we saw before. So it has been drawn such that all the edges have approximately the same length. Whereas in the right figure, the planar map has been embedded into the standard Euclidean sphere S2. So this means that the planar map has been drawn on the sphere in such a way that no two edges cross each other. And there are various ways to define such drawings or embeddings, which can be viewed as discrete approximations of a conformal map. So now I will be giving some examples later. So when we draw or embed plan a map on the sphere, then we get an area measure and we get a metric or a distance function on the sphere. So remember that the plan a map, it has n vertices in total, and therefore it's natural to say that each vertex has mass 1 divided by n, because then we know that the total mass of the map will be equal to 1 as we, or independently of the value of n. And we say that, and we get a measure on the sphere by saying that the mass of some subset of the sphere is equal to the mass of the vertices that are contained in that set. So that's the definition of mu sub n. We also get a metric or a distance function d sub n on the sphere. So this is a function which is used to measure the distance between any pair of points on the sphere. So it is defined such that if we consider two embedded vertices on the sphere, for example, we can consider this vertex and this vertex, then we say that the distance between these two vertices is proportional to the graph distance between them. So again, since we are hoping to take some limit, we want that the total diameter of the sphere is of order one, as the size n of the planar map is n to infinity. And it turns out that in order for the diameter to remain of order one, then we should let the adjacent vertices have distance n to the power minus a quarter. So of course, this measure mu sub n and this metric d sub n, it depends on the exact way in which we were drawing the planar map. So it depends on precisely which conformal embedding we were using. But it is a conjecture that for a large class of discrete conformal embeddings, then d sub n and mu sub n converge as n is n to infinity. And it converges to some random metric on the sphere and some random measure on the sphere. And it's also believed that the limiting measure and the limiting metric doesn't depend on the exact choice of conformal embedding that was chosen. So in the work I'm presenting, then we are proving one special case of this conjecture. So we prove the conjecture for one particular choice of embedding. So to be a bit more precise, in our result, we are not considering triangulations. We are considering triangulations with a boundary. So this is illustrated in the figures. So a triangulation with a boundary, it is a planar map where all faces have degree three, except for the exterior face. So the exterior face is given by the complement of the map, and this exterior face is allowed to have an arbitrary degree. In the right part of the figure, you can see a simulation of such a triangulation with a boundary, where this red curve that you can see here, this curve is representing the boundary of the triangulation. Okay, so I will now be stating the convergence result proof. So we start by sampling a uniform triangulation of triangulation such that the number of vertices is n and the boundary length is equal to the square root of n. And then we embed this triangulation into the standard equilateral triangle. So in the left part of the figure, then we consider a planar map, which is only defined modular continuous deformations, while in the middle figure, each vertex has one specific location in the equilateral triangle. So this rule that we use for drawing the planar map, we call it the Cardy embedding. So I will come back to exactly how we define it, but the idea is to use properties of percolation on the planar map. And also since we consider a planar map with a boundary, it's more natural to embed it in the equilateral triangle than in the sphere, as we considered before. So when we embed the planar map, then we get some area measure mu sub n in the equilateral triangle. This area measure is defined as before by considering counting measure on the vertices such that each vertex has mass 1 divided by n. We also get the metric or distance function in the equilateral triangle, which can be used to measure the distance between any point in a pair of points in the equilateral triangle. And as before, if we consider two embedded vertices, then the distance between these two points will be proportional to the graph distance between them. Then we'll let mu be the area measure, which is given by which is associated with the Liouville quantum gravity surface, where the parameter gamma of the surface is equal to the special values, the square root of 8/3. We also let d denote the metric, which is associated with this area measure mu. So then we can show that in this setting, mu sub n, as we send n to infinity, then mu sub n is converging to mu, and d sub n is converging to d. So to be a bit more precise, we show that it's possible to define these sequence of planar maps, m sub n, and a Gaussian free field on the same probability space, such that with probability 1, the measure mu sub n converges to mu, and d sub n is converging to d. So for example, this means that for an arbitrary ball A, then containing a collateral triangle, then the measure of this ball as measured by mu sub n converges to the measure as given by mu. And it also means that for any two points, z and w in the equilateral triangle, then the distance between these two points as measured by d sub n converges to the distance as measured by d. And this holds uniformly over all points z and w. In the convergence result on the previous slide, then a very important point which I haven't specified yet is exactly how this embedding was defined. So when we were drawing our planar map in the equilateral triangle, exactly which rule did we use for drawing the planar map? So that's what we call the Cardi embedding, and the next goal is to describe this. In the left part of the figure, we consider a planar map, and our goal is to draw this planar map in the equilateral triangle in some sort of conformal way. So we want to embed it in a conformal way into the equilateral triangle. So the first thing that one can observe is that such an embedding, it can't be unique. So it can't be unique because there are a number of conformal maps from the equilateral triangle and to itself. But if we fix three vertices on the boundary of the planar map, and we require that they are mapped to the three vertices of the equilateral triangle, then there should be a unique or approximately unique way to embed it. Because the only conformal map which is fixing the location of the three boundary vertices of the equilateral triangle is the identity map. So we can choose three such vertices, little a, little b, and little c, uniform at random from the boundary measure. So now we know to which points we want to send these three vertices, little a, little b, and little c. They should be sent to the boundary vertices of the equilateral triangle. And then we consider some arbitrary vertex v, and we ask to which location in the equilateral triangle do we want to send the vertex v. The idea of our approach is to use crossing events for percolation. So here you can see percolation on the equilateral, on the triangle lattice restricted to the equilateral triangle, and we have some point x in the equilateral triangle. And then we can consider the event that there is a blue crossing separating b and c from x and a. So it follows from Smirnov's result that I described before, that if the position of x is fixed and the lattice size is sent to zero, then the probability of having such a crossing is converging to a constant. And I denote this constant by p sub a of x. So then we can consider the exact same event on the planar map. So we have our marked vertex v. And we consider the event that there is a blue percolation crossing separating A and B from B and C. We will have such a percolation crossing with some probability between 0 and 1. And the probability of having a crossing we denote it by P hat sub A of V. Okay, so that as we can define P sub B and P sub C in a similar way as we define P sub A. And then when we embed this vertex V, then we send the vertex V to the point X of the equilateral triangle, such that this triple of probabilities associated with X is equal to the triple of probabilities associated with V. Okay, so that's the definition of our embedding. So we proved this theorem in a special case when the planar map was a uniformly sampled triangulation, and we embedded using this card embedding. But the theorem is actually believed to hold in a much bigger neurality. So it is believed also to hold, so we consider the card embedding, but it's believed that the exact same result also holds for a large class of other embeddings. We can also consider planar maps with other local constraints. So instead of considering triangulations, we can consider quadrangulations where all the faces have four edges. We can consider arbitrary maps where there are no constraints and so on. And one can also consider planar maps in other universality classes. So we consider uniformly sampled planar maps, but there are a number of other natural probability measures that one can put on the space of planar maps. For example, one can sample a planar map such that the probability of sampling a particular map is proportional to some statistical physics partition function on the planar map. So if we reweight the law of the planar map in such a way, then it is believed that we also get LQG in the scaling limit, but it will typically be LQG with another value of gamma. So the parameter gamma will not be equal to the square root of 8/3 anymore. So in the previous slide, I mentioned that the card embedding is just one of many of a large class of embeddings that one can consider. So here I have presented a few other, I have listed a few other embeddings, which are also viewed as discrete conformal embeddings. So first on the list is the circle packing, which is also illustrated in the figure. So a circle packing is defined such that each vertex of the planar map is associated with a circle, and two circles are tangent to each other if and only if the corresponding vertices are connected by an edge. It is possible to argue that that for if we have a triangulation, then the circle packing exists, and it's also a unique modulo the application of a conformal map. So this fact that the circle packing is unique modulo the application of a conformal map, it somehow hints on the fact that this circle packing is reflecting conformal properties of the planar map. And a result by Rodin and Sullivan from 87 is giving some more justification for this. So in their result, they consider some simply connected domain D, and they consider the triangular lattice restricted to this domain D. This is shown in red. So the triangular lattice restricted to D is defining a planar map. So we can embed it into the unit circle, into the unit disk by using a circle packing. So this is shown in the figure. So such an embedding, it gives us a map psi sub n, which is sending a vertex in the left figure to the vertex to the corresponding vertex in the right part of the figure. So it's giving us a map from D to the unit disk. And Rodin and Sullivan, they prove that this map psi sub n, it converges to the conformal map from D to the unit disk. So this explains why we view the circle packing as a discrete conformal map. An alternative is to one can also embed the planar map by using what is called the uniformization theorem. A planar map, it can be viewed as a Riemannian manifold by giving each triangle the metric of the standard equilateral triangle. So in other words, we have a collection of standard equilateral triangles, and we glue them together as indicated by the combinatorial structure of the planar map. So this will give us some smooth manifold, except possibly at the vertices of the triangles, where we may have some conical singularities. There is a result known as the uniformization theorem, which is saying that if we have some simply connected Riemann surface, then there is a conformal map from the surface to either the unit disk, the complex plane, or the sphere. So by this uniformization theorem, we know that there exists a conformal map from our planar map viewed as a manifold to this unit disk. So that's a second way of embedding. So a third way of embedding is to consider the tet embedding. So the tet embedding is defined such that the location of a vertex is the average of the location of the neighboring vertices. And it's possible if the boundary data are, if the location of the boundary vertices is fixed, then one can prove existence and uniqueness of the tet embedding. Okay, so then we have the fourth embedding, which is the Cardi embedding. So this embedding is less classical than the other three embeddings. But one direct corollary of Smirnov's result is the analog of the result of Rodin and Sullivan. In the setting of the circle packing. So in other words, if we consider this planar map and we embed it using the Cardi embedding in this, for example, in the equilateral triangle, then Smirnov's result is implying that this embedding will converge to the conformal map between the two domains in the scaling limit. So we have these four different discrete conformal embeddings. So they are, as I mentioned, they are believed to be the same asymptotically, in the sense that if we have a planar map and we embed it using two of these methods, then each vertex should be sent to the approximately the same location with the two methods, uniformly over all vertices. But there are few rigorous relationships between these four embeddings. So to sum up, we have been considering universal and canonical random two-dimensional objects, and we have seen that a uniformly sampled triangulation is converging to Liouville quantum gravity under this Cardi embedding. And one interesting future direction is to prove universality, which is to extend the result to other embeddings and also to other models for planar maps. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Nina, for that great talk. So let me start by asking, are there any students in the audience who have questions? If not, I have a question, but maybe let me ask first, are there other questions? Laurent, did I see that you were about to ask something? Or Jaume?
I have a question, yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a very nice talk. Would be useful to know for which values of the Virasoro central charge are you finding kind of a discrete bird? I mean, are you matching on with Liouville theory?
So there are somehow two different central charges that one can consider. So one can consider this Liouville central charge. So that is equal to 26.
Okay.
The matter central charge is zero.
Okay. Yeah.
Good.
So are you saying that it's not known how to move away from the sequence 26?
So it's not known in the setting of these conformal embeddings. So I was mentioning earlier that one can prove convergence of planar maps in different senses. That's shown on this slide. In the community of probabilists, there are typically like three different senses of convergence that one considers. So this this third notional convergence has only been established for uniform maps, which is the 26, C equal to 26. It's also the same for the metric properties. This second notional convergence has been established also in other universality classes.
Because from the continuum point of view, somehow it's believed that there's a nice analytic continuation of Liouville correlators to the complex plane. I mean, from the continuum point of view, the value, I mean, there's something special about C equals 26, but there is an analytic continuation of the correlation functions away from
that. Yeah, exactly. So from the continuum point of view, I would say that that somehow C equals 26 is somehow not, I mean, it is special in some ways, but it's somehow, but on the other hand, there are a lot of things that can be defined in the exact same way for all values, for like at least a range of C values.
I mean, you may have some poles with some funny values of C, but generically, I think you can analytically continue to the plane.
I think at least in the math literature, I think there were at least for a while it was defined if for C greater than 25 it was first considered, and then I think it has been extended. It has been extended to more points as well. It has also been extended to certain complex values, these correlation functions.
Okay.
So
maybe another related question is that, I mean, Liouville is kind of an example of a discrete parameter of theories. The next one would be what's called Toller theory, in which essentially the two-dimensional theory has not only Virasoro symmetry, but has a higher spin symmetry. And actually, one of the things that has been a mystery, and maybe this point of view would help, is that it's not really clear what the geometry associated to the W symmetry is. So I'm wondering if, from your point of view, there is any insight on how you would try to get to, say, W geometry or Toller theory from this probabilistic point of view. Does this provide any insight into
the geometry? I think I'm not quite familiar with that theory to answer the question. I'm not too familiar with that.
Yeah, so this was an attempt to generalize like two-dimensional theories where on top of having just a bit of sort of symmetry, which is generated by an energy momentum tensor that has a spin 2, you would have extra conserved currency of spin 3.
Okay.
You could couple then that theory to some kind of generalization of metric, which is not really clear what it is, in fact. And you could define, there's analogs of Liouville correlators for, in the continuum, these are called Toller theories. And so, but the big question is, what is the geometry of these theories, essentially? So I was thinking that maybe this would help giving some perspective.
Maybe it could. I'm not familiar enough with that perspective to answer.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Laurent.
I have a very elementary question. Thank you for the talk. Maybe I missed, you know, the first few minutes, so maybe you answer there. There's this parameter gamma that plays a role in your theory. So can you tell me what this parameter is in terms of physics language? Like, is it the central charge, the spinning?
Yeah, count? Exactly. So that was actually also the previous question. So if you have the gamma, so that's we typically call it like a coupling constant, and then we have current charge Q, which is 2/γ plus gamma over 2. And then we have the central charge, which I think is, I think it's 1 plus 6 Q squared. Mm-hmm. Okay. So particularly this, so it means that in particular, we are considering,
So then you do have a range, right? Because you said that gamma is between 0 and 2, so that's a range of something.
So in general, we do consider, so we can define like the measure and metric, the label measure and the label metric for gamma between 0 and 2. And that corresponds to the central charge ranging between 25 and infinity.
Okay. But then it's only for a certain, okay, so then maybe that's what your previous answer. So if you put squares or, so you can only achieve one value of gamma, but you were saying you could achieve different values of gamma.
Yeah, exactly. So the scaling limit result, that one can only consider one value of gamma. So the previous question was somehow also, it was also pointing out that in a continuum, one actually has this value, this special value, central charge equal to 26, doesn't play a so special role, because one can, there are a lot of quantities which is just varying continuously as one varies the central charge. But on the discrete side, this special case of 26 is playing a special role because it corresponds to uniformly sampled planar maps, and there are a number of, like, for example, combinatorial techniques that are easier, which can be used for that case, but not in other cases.
Is this limit independent on whether you use triangle or squares or pentagons?
So I think that actually a lot of the results in this talk can actually also be carried out for other maps
with the same
with the same limiting object. Discussing a little bit about more general versions, so how to adapt to other settings, and I think that probably this second bullet point with local map constraints is probably the one, it's probably the way in which it's easiest to generalize the result.
Could I ask a question? I know. So this work, of course, was about 2D. What is the status of higher dimensions? Are there candidate analogs of Liouville quantum gravity that are sort of natural best descriptions of random geometry in higher dimensions
There is. At least in my community, there is very little progress on it so far. I think I saw someone in the audience has been working on this. Let me see if he's still there. Someone, one of the participants in the talk is actually one of, I think has some work on this, so he can maybe explain more if he's there. Luca Leoni, I think has a work on it. I'm actually not so familiar with the status of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a work in which we introduce random gluings on random surfaces to produce new non-trivial random objects. But it's not very canonical in the sense that, for instance, we don't know how to obtain it as a limit of triangulations.
Uh-huh, okay. And what about the Schramm-Lohner evolution? Is there any natural analog of that in higher dimensions?
So there are some of the objects that converge to the SLE in 2D. So it can also be defined in higher dimensions. And I think there are also some conjectures that there should be interesting. That it should have a scaling limit. For example, in the case of the uniform both the uniform spanning tree and the loop res random walk, they converge to SLE curves, and the scaling limit has been established that there is a scaling limit in 3D as well. I think also for some percolation models, there are also some conjectures and simulations that support that there are limiting paths also in higher dimensions. But the mathematical understanding of these objects is very small. Except that it has been, I would say, the loop raised walk and the UST, there has been at least established a scaling limit result, but the understanding of the continuum object is not so good at the moment.
Okay.
And there is also not any sort of uniform in the 2D case. One has this nice theory that somehow covers a huge class of models, and there isn't unifying theory in 3D, for example.
Okay, thanks. Were there any other questions?
Yeah, maybe I can ask another one that just came to mind. That so in the case of in liberal theory, one can also, I mean, people studied also the situation in which the surface has a boundary and put different conformally invariant boundary conditions, and those are believed to be classified in terms of the primaries of the Bierasoro algebra. So I'm just wondering what aspect of these boundary states are reproducible from this probabilistic point of view.
So I think that's so there hasn't been made a lot of work on it. There is some work on that. So for example, if you let's say you have a planar map with let's say an easing model, and you just have like Dobrich and boundary tests, you have like one, you have boundary arc with plus, another one with minus.
Mm-hmm.
Have an interface between plus and minus. So in that case, if you look at the limiting surface, so the limiting surface will be an LQG, a Liouville quantum gravity surface, but at those special points where the interface starts and ends, there will be some special singularities. So there will be some logarithmic singularities.
So are these, but these are like local operators?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I was thinking more of, imagine you take the disk, Liouville theory on the disk. So now you can ask, okay, let me study conformally invariant boundary conditions on the boundary of the disk.
And there
is an infinite family of such boundary conditions that are labeled by, as I said, by representations of the Bierasoro algebra. So, and each of one defines a set of correlation functions with which now you could ask, okay, let me study like the correlation function of a local operator in the presence of that boundary. So that, so I was asking, how are those probed from your point of view, those observables?
Okay, those I am actually not, I am not familiar with any sort of probabilistic realization of those. I think the only sort of, the modifications, So I think the only sort of variations in boundary data that we consider would be sort of single points at which the boundary data is changing. It would be sort of more, it would be just like one can consider. So there are ways of realizing, let's say you have a disk, let's say you have like 10 marked points with different kinds of singularities. There are ways of realizing that probabilistically. But I think that's the only sort of variation in boundary data that we would consider.
All right, thank you.
I have a feeling we should, in view of time, we should probably end it there unless there's any other pressing questions. If not, let's thank Nina one more time for a very fascinating talk, and congratulations on a great result. Thank you, and see you all next week.